Good morning from 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. And welcome to our election special candidates forum. As each Saturday this month, we speak to one candidate vying for the Democratic nomination for congressperson from Virginia's 5th District. The program is underwritten by the Daily Progress with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Now here are your hosts, Bob McAdams and Jeff Leonard.
Good morning. I'm Jeff Leonard, General Manager of 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
And I'm Bob McAdams, Special Events Coordinator at WPVC. And
today we're co-hosting a 94.7 WPVC election special, one of four interviews, each with a Democratic candidate for Congress from the 5th District. 94.7 WPVC does not endorse any candidate for public office, but we provide this information to help our listeners choose the best candidate. And you, our listeners, are helping us by submitting your questions.
With us in the studio this morning is congressional candidate Roger Dean Hufstetler. R.D., welcome to WPVC.
Thank you all very much for having me today.
R.D., we'll start by getting to know a little bit about you. Where were you born and what was life like for R.D. when he was growing up?
I was born in the Gaston County Hospital down in North Carolina. My dad grew up on a farm in Lincoln County, just next door. And, you know, I really come from an area of the world where people work with their hands. My grandmother worked in a mill for 40 years. My other grandfather drove a 18-wheeler. My other grandfather, William Barger, has an interesting story. Both of his parents were dead when he was 15, actually. And he had to lie about his age so he could get a job driving an 18-wheeler with the Carolina Freight Company. And so the Bargers on that side and the Hufstetlers on my dad's side, they have a long history of being hardworking folks, honestly. And that was one thing that was impressed upon me, you know, from a very early age, was that, you know, being a Hufstetler means you work hard. And so, you know, we've talked a little bit about my upbringing in this campaign. And my fondest memory of my dad was going down to the family farm on Saturdays. And we would go see his mom, Mama Sue, who's still alive and 88 years old down in North Carolina. And we would feed the cows after we would go visit with her. And that was a very special time for us, just reminiscing about, you know, how he grew up and, you know, that time in America where that was really important to have that dignity of a job and work with your hands. And my dad himself drove a forklift for Ford for 30 years and retired from Ford Motor Company, something he was very proud of, to work for a great American company. And, you know, the other thing I'll say is, you know, everything wasn't always easy for us growing up. My parents struggled with substance abuse, and my dad actually passed away from an OxyContin overdose. And so, you know, that's a big part of my identity, is that I want to make sure that we send people into politics, into the Congress, that understand what working people are going through in our country today. And there's a lot of areas of our country that are feeling left out, and we just want to make sure they're included.
Now, as you got older, you began to make choices for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
How about your education and your career? And I think you've had two careers almost there. Mm-hmm. How have they prepared you to be a member of Congress?
Yeah, so I'm the first in my family to graduate from college, and a big reason, there are two big reasons that happened. The first is that there's a great program in Georgia where I grew up called the Hope Scholarship. And the Hope Scholarship allows any student in the state with a B average to go to any state school tuition free. So that made an enormous impact on me and the Hufstetlers. And, you know, I'm really proud to be a Hope Scholar. I want to advocate for more policies like that when people are working hard and following the rules that they get invested in. The second reason, you know, I was the first in my family to graduate from college. You know, my dad said to me, when are you going to come work at Ford with me? And that's what he had done. His dad had worked at Ford, too. So, but I had a high school chemistry teacher named Susan Smith. And early in chemistry, she sat me down and said, you know, I had a discussion with that biology teacher, and he said, you're making B's, you're a B student. Why aren't you making A's? And so a big reason I'm doing this is, you know, I want every student to have a Susan Smith in their life. I think it's extremely important that we have high quality, great teachers in every zip code in this country. And I was just really fortunate, you know, to have someone like Susan Smith helping me. So that's a big part of my identity is, you know, I believe in public education as the great equalizer in our society, and I want everybody to be included. I would say additionally, you know, serving as a Marine is the honor of my life. I was really proud to become a Marine and have that experience. And I think, you know, right now the country is really looking for people to put the country in front of partisan politics. And, you know, the current person who holds this seat, he puts his ideology over ideas to make the country better. He puts the House Freedom Caucus in front of the country, and he puts a special interest in front of us. And what really drives me is being that opposite person in politics that's going to fight for what I believe in, try to make a difference in the country, and most specifically, just try to make progress every day. And I think, you know, being a Marine in a mission-driven unit, you really learn that. You learn that, you know, it doesn't matter if you come from a big state or a small place, if you're Republican or Democrat, the mission has to come first, and that's what we want our campaign to be about. And I think that's prepared me to do a good job as the potentially the next congressman here in the 5th District.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 5th District Congressional Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard, today with my good friend Bob McAdams. With us in the studio today is R.D. Hufstetler. R.D., what have you been doing in the 5th District in recent years that sets your candidacy apart from the other candidates for the Democratic nomination?
Yeah, as I said earlier, I was born in North Carolina. I grew up in Georgia. And as serving as a Marine and working in technology, I kind of moved around a bit. But when Emily and I were ready to, you know, decide what's next for us and start a family, it seemed to us that this was the best place in the country to raise a family. So Emily is an OBGYN at the Martha Jefferson Hospital here. You know, she's sort of the breadwinner in our family right now, which is great. And I have been a special advisor to the TomTom Founders Festival since shortly after I moved here and been involved with them. So that's love that organization. I think it's doing a lot for the community and, you know, continue want to be involved with what they're doing.
You know, running for Congress is a big deal. There's a lot of sacrifice. My friend Eric, who's probably listening in South Carolina, ran as a Democrat in the Congressional 2 district down there against Joe Wilson. And he wrote a book called I Ran for Congress, and all I got was this lousy bankruptcy. You know, it's a lot of sacrifice. Why did you decide to run, considering the current climate?
Well, the current climate is the reason I'm running. I don't think we need people in politics like Tom Garrett, who simply aren't willing to believe in our fundamental American values of progress and compromise. And obviously, with the election of Donald Trump, that brought a lot of people forward in politics to say, you know, I think we can do better.
But it also took a lot of people. I mean, if you look at local races, regional races, and statewide races, there's so much animus right now. And where once you were treated with dignity and respect, people that are running for office these days are often subject of doxing, subjects of outright hate threats, and it does take its toll.
Mm-hmm.
So, what have you experienced any of that? And are you prepared when the sharp knives come out? What are you doing to prepare yourself for that?
Well, you know, FDR famously said, "I relish their hatred." And so, listen, you got to understand who you are in this job. You got to be able to put your head on that pillow at night and say, you know, I'm doing this for the right reason. I believe in who I am, and the experiences I've had have prepared me to do this job. And that's what you got to do. Look in the mirror every day and know who you are. And I luckily have a great spouse, very supportive, kind, you know, has a career outside of politics that she's interested in and keeps me informed on women's health issues every day. And I think that's it. Like, the most important thing in my personal life is my wife, Emily, and our new baby, Alice Sue Hufstetler. It keeps you pretty grounded every day when you're changing a diaper or two or whatever I get time to do. And I think, I just lost my train of thought there.
Sorry. Your baby's young.
Yes, she's a month old, a month and a week old.
Congratulations. That's a hard time. It's a fun time, but a hard time, I can tell you from experience.
Yes, it's very fun and hard.
Right, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 5th District Congressional Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams, and with us in the studio today is R.D. Hufstetler. Already a top issue for all the candidates is health care. You've mentioned that already. But straight off, do you believe that health care is a right? And if so, how do you propose to make health care a reality for all people?
Health care is 100% a right. Right now in our country, a person's zip code determines their life expectancy. And I don't think that's exactly what was envisioned in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So we just got to get back to making sure we're fighting for quality, affordable health care in every zip code. One of the things that we need to celebrate is the ACA. what we're able to do in ACA is make sure that 20 million more Americans have health insurance. That's a big deal. That's something we should be excited about. We should fight for. We got to remember we got rid of gender ratings, which means that women could be charged more for their health care. We got rid of pre-existing conditions. We got rid of lifetime caps. A lot of big progress. But what's happening now is this administration is trying to whittle away those protections in two big ways. One, they've removed the individual mandate. And second, they're ending something called cost-sharing agreements. There's a bipartisan bill in the Senate to protect these cost-sharing agreements to make sure that we have smoothed out the changes in the premiums across districts, across counties, and different states. And I will fight to make sure that those are present there. So that's my basic position here is we need to fight for quality, affordable health care in every zip code.
So you'd be improving the ACA as it's written, mm-hmm. or it was intended to be written, before the began the sabotage by the Republican Party.
That's exactly right, and we're going to go one step further in this campaign as well. We want to we support Tim Kaine's plan for Medicare X. What Medicare X does is allow to use the existing infrastructure to put a public option in some of the communities that don't have a private sector option. We think that's extremely important for folks in our rural communities if competition isn't coming there to make sure that they have an option to be included.
Are you a supporter of Medicare for all or single payer?
Yeah, so let's talk about single payer. There are three key variables in delivery of health care in our country: access, coverage, and quality. Medicare for all deals with coverage, and it's an important and laudable goal and one that we should fight for. But just because someone has coverage does not mean they have access or quality. And what I mean by that is, let's take someone in Southside who lives in one of our rural counties, Charlotte County, Ludenburn County. You know, the question isn't just, do they have health insurance? The question is, do they have a quality doctor that's close by? Do they have a quality hospital they can get to? So that's why I believe that Medicare X is the next step we should take in making sure we have quality, affordable health care in every zip code.
Now, another big issue is the economy. We have a question from a listener in Charlottesville about the economy, and the questioner asks, in America, the richest country in history, the top 1% own most of the wealth, while more than 45 million Americans are living below the poverty line. Good jobs are being automated and people replaced by machines and computers at the same time that corporations are earning record profits. How do you define the problems with our economy, and what should Congress do about it?
Central question of our time, right there. You nailed it. What we need to do to fix the economy is address what's called the middle skills gap. And, Bob, I had a mentor named Joe Lasseter. He's a professor of energy, and he's from Arkansas. And I asked him about this problem, and he said, Roger Dean, the economy can't just be Uber drivers and college professors. We got to have something in the middle, son. And I believe he's nailed the problem in that story, because what's happening now is we have a lot of really high-skilled workers and a lot of folks in our service sector, but the middle-class jobs are really missing right now. And the middle-class jobs have been the glue for our democracy for a long time now. And what do we got to get back to is making sure that when people get through our institutions here in Central Virginia and Southside, that they enter the economy. And let me give you an example. At the Danville Community College, they've been able to partner with the local high schools, and students can actually take their last year, use their last year in high school as that first year of community college. And then they go to community college, and then they enter the economy right away, working with their hands in advanced manufacturing, making $65,000, $70,000 a year. It's that kind of specialized thinking, Bob, that we need here in the 5th District. I have developed a robust economic development plan. I believe it's the best economic development plan of any challenger in the country. We're really proud of it. We'll be putting it up on our website for what we call a virtual listening tour on it here shortly. But the basic idea is that we tie together our research institutions, our community colleges, and our private sector leadership so that people are focused on skills, not just degrees. Now, let me be clear. I have a liberal arts education. Because of Susan Smith, I studied chemistry. I fully support that. But we've also got to have a path in our society so that people that want to work with their hands or other factors like that want to be in the trades, they have a path forward too. And I think my economic development plan can help us get back to the basics on that.
You're leaning right into the next question, which is about the education system. Now, for some people, it's a great success. Some of the students that we see are, you know, really accomplished young men and women. What are you hearing from students and teachers about the problems that they face? Because for some students, mm-hmm. the education system is a real failure.
That's true. We are not education is not being the great equalizer right now. It is continuing to separate us, and I don't think it has to. One of the biggest factors is what I mentioned earlier. We have got to have high quality teachers in every high school in this country. They need to be paid well. They need to be trained well. They need to be supported in their jobs. That's the first factor. The second factor is testing. Listen, I think if we went back 10 or 15 years, we probably did need a little more testing in schools. I think right now the pendulum has swung way too far, and we need to work getting that back a little bit so teachers have a little bit more breathing room. And remember, you don't get a job in the changing economy because you passed a test. You get a job in the changing economy because you have a set of skills that someone wants to pay you for. And we got to get back to understanding that that's really the purpose of these institutions, and we need to support them in that process.
So the president has, in my view, has tried to close the failed schools to prisons, the prison pipeline, and just make our schools prisons by making teachers armed guards. What's your feeling on what the president's trying to do, and what's your plan, or what are your thoughts to sort of keep our children safe and while they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is sitting in school?
Well, first of all, if I have anything to do with it, we are not going to arm teachers in this country. That is a completely flawed plan. Training teachers to teach is enough of a burden to the system. I was trained as a Marine. I think everybody knows that. I was at Parris Island for 13 weeks. They give you an M16 on day one, and you know you don't pull the trigger on a live round until about 42 days into that experience. So for me, it takes a lot of training to be a good marksman. And the other thing that I think people like the president are not understanding is that Marines train people for marksmanship, and then they train people to, you know, participate in combat as well. There are different types of training, and we don't need to be arming our teachers in any capacity to reduce gun violence in our country. That's not a solution. There are a robust set of solutions to reduce gun violence on our website. And if it's okay, I'll just talk through a couple of those right now.
Please do.
The first is we have got to repeal what's called the Dickey Amendment. The Dickey Amendment prevents the federal government from studying the root cause of gun violence. The author of that bill, by the way, was a man named Jay Dickey. He was a Republican from Arkansas, and before he died, he called for the repeal of the Dickey Amendment. He said it was a mistake. The second thing we got to do is have comprehensive background checks so terrorists, domestic abusers, criminals cannot get weapons that they don't need to be getting. We need to work together to get that done. There is a bill in the Senate sponsored by a Republican senator from Texas and a Democratic senator from Connecticut that I would view favorably, the Fix NICS bill. The third thing we need to do is make sure we're standing up for gun violence restraining orders. This is a bottom-up approach so that a woman or a man can feel safe in their home. They're allowed to petition a local judge. And what I like about this model is it's very scalable, it's very bottom-up, and it's very quick. And these are, even Marco Rubio in Florida has stood up and said this is a good idea. And the last thing is, obviously, we need to ban these weapons of war. This is not something that a regular citizen ought to be able to buy off the internet. The way I came to this conclusion was I talked to my Uncle Bill, who's a big Trump supporter and who carried a weapon like this in Vietnam. And I said, Uncle Bill, what do you think we should do here? And he said, we should ban these weapons. I talked to my cousin who teaches high school down in North Carolina. He's also a Republican. And he immediately said, banning these weapons won't fully solve the problem, but it's the first step and we have to do it. So I think there's a lot of support in this country from regular, everyday Republicans, independents, and Democrats to make sure that regular citizens can't get easy access to weapons of war.
You mentioned your website a couple of times. What's the URL?
RD for VA, RDFORVA.com. And we've put up there an extensive policy on opioid abuse. Since that issue, you know, affected my family personally, I wanted to try to be a leader on that issue. We have an extensive energy policy we're extremely proud of up there as well. And then most recently, we have two pieces on gun violence. One is a letter to my dad, who was an NRA member, explaining to him these conversations, which I just mentioned, and then a comprehensive approach to reducing gun violence, which we're very proud of.
Thanks, RD. This is a great discussion. We need to take a short break. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville's 5th District Congressional Candidate Forum. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back. I'm Jeff Leonard, co-hosting with Bob McAdams, 94.7 WPVC election special interview with congressional candidate R.D. Hustetler. Bob and R.D., we're talking about the issues.
And the issues don't get any easier, including this question from a listener in Charlottesville. The listener writes, the earth is warming, ice caps melting, sea levels rising, we're getting unprecedented tropical storms, floods, and extreme heat. Climate change is happening to us daily, and the future looks worse. What is your comprehensive plan to reduce climate change?
I want the 5th District of Virginia to be a leader on this issue. I want us to be as close to what I term, you know, energy independence as we possibly can. We are living in the congressional district in Virginia that has the most green energy jobs, and I want to continue to help accelerate that growth. And what we say in our energy paper is what I say all around this district. I want every American to be able to collect, store, and sell their own energy. And that distributed approach really is the future. It's going to help change the model that's working right now. As we see technology continue to accelerate, battery capacity to improve, solar efficiency to improve along with wind, we're going to be able to lead on this issue here in the 5th District, and that's exciting. And the other reason it's exciting, Bob, is because what this is going to allow us to do is partner the demand for clean energy in our small cities with the potential supply from some of our rural countryside. And that is the kind of person I want to be in politics that brings us together, that talks about issues that can create jobs, not just in our small cities, but also in the country. And that's really important to my identity, to talk about this in a way that everybody can see themselves participating in a solution to this very persistent and urgent need.
Here's another tough question.
Mm-hmm.
The Black Lives Matter movement and the events in Charlottesville in July and August of last summer confront us with the racism in our society. What should be the response personally and legislatively so that we can finally overcome racism?
I think August 12th here in Charlottesville was the most tense moment I've had on American soil. You could smell the tear gas in the air. Rocks were strewn at protesters. And, you know, it was scary. And I'm a white male Marine. So I'll never know what it feels like to be an African-American in this country or particularly that day. But what I want to do on this campaign is to try to understand what that life experience is like. One of our core values on this campaign is empathy. And I was so proud to see that, you know, on the Black Lives platform, empathy is one of their core values as well. And that's what we try to do in this campaign. We try to get out of bed every day and try to understand what other people are going through. It might be someone in a zip code that felt left out by Hillary Clinton's message of America, or it might be someone who felt included on Donald Trump's message of America. But either way, we want to listen. And we want to try, you know, the good thing about empathy, Bob, is it's a renewable resource. You can get better at it every day. And that's what I'm going to try to do in this campaign, is try to understand what people are going through and work on that as part of our what we call our push-ups on our campaign, the job of trying to be that candidate that can do a good job. As far as legislatively, there are some two really good bills in the Congress right now. One is for bail reform. Which helps people, you know, we shouldn't be setting these bail levels so that if you make one mistake, your entire life ends in the criminal justice system. If you make a small mistake, then you can't get to work, you lose your car, and now you're just part of the system. We don't want that to happen. So I support that bill. It's actually co-sponsored by a liberal senator from California and a conservative senator from Kentucky. So I support that bill. The other thing is we've got to have sentencing reform in this country. We cannot be, I'm a Christian, I believe in redemption. We've got to make sure our criminal justice system reflects that as well. So this is an issue that I continue to learn about, and I hope to learn about for the rest of my time in public service, but I'm so happy I was there that day to see what was happening here in our community.
Yeah, along those lines, I received one of your mailers the other day, and maybe it was yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and you had Tom Garrett's picture with a person here from Charlottesville who has a lot of notoriety for bringing the Nazis and the alt-right to Charlottesville. What was the purpose of that? What was the purpose of that picture, including that picture?
Tom Garrett is part of the House Freedom Caucus in D.C. And I personally believe that the House Freedom Caucus is a cancer on our country right now that is preventing the government from functioning properly. These are 25 people in D.C. who think they know better than the American people, and they are only accountable to the Koch brothers. I do not think that's who we are as a country, as a commonwealth, or as a district. Now, as a congressman, you meet with a lot of folks. You do. Sometimes you can control where those meetings happen, and sometimes you can't. But the idea that the white supremacist who organized the August 12th rally had an official meeting on Capitol Hill with Tom Garrett is completely unacceptable. He has never taken responsibility for it. He has never apologized for it. He has never explained to us what the purpose of the meeting was. And therefore, it is we are going to hold him accountable for that meeting.
Yeah, you're exactly right. He turns it. When pinned on that question, he turns it into a joke. He says, "Oh well, you mean the George Soros plant and the Occupy protester that was there?" So I think that's exactly. I think that's correct. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the 5th District Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard in studio along with Bob McAdams, and today we have R.D. Hufstetler. R.D., we touched on this a little while ago, but I want to pin you for an answer. R.D., mm-hmm. Gun violence takes a terrible toll in America. School shooting in Parkland, Florida enrages the students who are clearly and forcefully demanding legislators pass common sense gun laws. You know, I posted the other day from the radio station page that, you know, did you see what those children do? All politicians, Democrats, Republicans, everyone has failed them. And those children are coming for them. Mm-hmm. They're coming for you. If you are a politician listening, they are coming for you. What gun laws do you support in Congress? You touched on that a bit. And will you refuse to accept campaign donations or support from the National Rifle Association?
I will never take a penny from the NRA. I believe that their leadership is focused on the wrong things. It used to be an organization that was focused on gun safety, people feeling safe, whether they're shooting a gun for sportsmanship or other self-protective measures. But I think anybody who's watching this debate right now can see that they are much more concerned with the gun manufacturers than responsible gun owners. I have no beef with card-carrying member of the NRA who just wants to protect their family or go hunting. I have no beef with them. And as I mentioned, my dad was a member of the NRA. I obviously cared about him and want his perspective to be represented in the future of the country, too. But that's different than what's happening right now. The positions they take are so extreme that we're not able to have a conversation about this in our country. And that's what the students are protesting. They are protesting, once again, how the special interest of the 10 or 15% in this country are able to block what 80% of Americans want. And that is really what this election is going to be about this November. This is going to be the last cycle where folks like the House Freedom Caucus constrain our ability to solve our own problems. And those students are helping, and I applaud them for standing up for what they believe in. And this is more than those students, though. This is the country saying, get back to work, put the country first, get the job done.
You know, another issue that affects young people is immigration, especially here at 94.7 WPVC, where we broadcast about 24 hours a week in Spanish. You know, people are brought to America as children, had the protection from deportation under President Obama. But President Trump has taken away that protection for the Dreamers, you know, DACA, and also temporary protected status from El Salvadorians. What would you do to keep the Dreamers here in the temporary protective status? And where do you stand on immigration law in general?
Another great example of, you know, 70-80% of Americans think we should protect Dreamers. I believe that. Your parents make all sorts of decisions you can't be responsible for. This is the country many of these folks have, the only country they've known. I served in the Marine Corps with Marines who came from all over the world. Families that came from Dominican Republic or Mexico or Puerto Rico, which is obviously American, but all sorts of folks like that. And I cannot imagine that we would deport a service member protecting us right now just because of a choice that their parents made. That seems deplorable. Not who we are as a country. Listen, any immigration bill that has a chance of passing probably has to have a combination of three things. It probably does have to increase border security. It has to address the Dreamers. And it has to be comprehensive so that folks who are being educated here in our country can also enter the economy here and help us build those great new jobs in the changing economy. So I would support a comprehensive approach. There was a bill through the Senate, I believe in 2013, that got about 68 votes. 68 votes. And yet, I don't believe it got a vote in the House of Representatives. So that's the kind of bill I would want to support, one that that the vast majority of Americans could get behind and say, yep, that seems like a common sense way to handle the issues that are going on right now.
It was one of the failures of Speaker Boehner. He never allowed that bill to come up for a vote in the House of Representatives. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 5th District Congressional Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams. RD, the Me Too movement is unmasking the abuse of power to extort sexual favors by men who control the future of women. At the same time, a woman's right to make her own reproductive choices is being challenged, and women still are often paid less than men for the same job. What should Congress do to protect the rights of women?
Well, let's start here first in Virginia. What do Texas, West Virginia, and Kentucky have in common? They all voted for Donald Trump, and they all have passed the Equal Rights Amendment. But Virginia has not, and that needs to be the first bill through the Senate next session. That's a big deal. It basically just says that women should be treated equally under the law, and we need to work on that. My wife, as I mentioned, Bob, is an OBGYN. And an OBGYN is with a woman on the best day of their life and sometimes the worst day of their life. And in the Huff-Stentler household, we talk about women's health every day, whether that is, you know, the extra chart she had to finish or how the procedure went that morning. And I just do not believe that we need to let men in distant capitals get between a woman and her doctor. That's extremely important to me that we don't allow that to happen. And I think I will obviously going to fight for that when I get to the Congress. We've obviously the Me Too movement is something that needs to be addressed. Right now, there is no universal policy in the House of Representatives to make sure that women feel safe at work. We need to change that. It needs to be one of the first things that that happens in the new Congress next year, a written policy that's universal that no member can squeeze out of. It's ridiculous that women can't feel safe. They don't have a way to report things that are happening in their offices, and I want to try to change that. The model for this, Bob, real quickly, sorry to interrupt, is in the military you have something called request mast, which is a procedure where any enlisted service member can speak to their commanding officer within a reasonable amount of time, say 24 or 48 hours. We need a vehicle like that in the House of Representatives so that everybody can feel safe at work.
Do you think it's time for the Equal Rights Amendment to be ratified?
Absolutely, yes. We need Virginia to work on that here in the state Senate and get that done. Virginia needs to lead the way on that.
On another issue, the Trump administration has proposed an infrastructure bill with no real funds. They're depending on private investment and private ownership. What plan do you have to rebuild and strengthen our nation's infrastructure?
Well, one of the things that happened in this tax bill, Bob, the Republicans have, you know, this tax bill costs us $1.5 trillion. The economists are studying right now what's the benefit to the economy on that. I will say one of the things I agree with in the bill in principle is this idea that we would let American companies repatriate some of their capital from overseas. That's actually a very good public policy. I think it's really smart. My nudge on this would have been, instead of simply bringing it back stateside, I would have flagged the revenue that we collected from that in what I might call an infrastructure bank. What this would allow us to do is to invest in projects around the country on a nonpartisan basis, basically, and help partner public capital with private capital and get some of these infrastructure projects done. We cannot allow countries like China to have world-class infrastructure while ours crumbles. We're not going to be the leader in the world's economy if we do that, and we need to get back to investing in our basic infrastructure in this country. I think a vehicle like an infrastructure bank, we don't have to call it that, but the basic premise here is how do we partner public capital with private capital to get the job done?
To clarify that, where do you stand on privatization of public functions? Private roads, private prisons?
Bob, it's not a question I get very frequently, to be honest with you. I would say that my immediate reaction is probably we should study this to see what kind of effect it has on quality and cost. I can imagine a situation where some functions are privatized, and that's a good thing, and then I can imagine other situations where it's a terrible idea. So I don't think there's a sort of universal, I support privatization or I don't. I'd want to see the studies in different functions of the government that we're hoping to deliver. I'll give you an example. You know, if you told me, you know, we want the garbage collection to be privatized, I think that's probably a pretty good idea. Do I want prisons to be privatized? I think I want to think very carefully about that policy before I'd come down on it either way.
You know, I think people will be supportive at least initially, of saying, yeah, I think the private road wouldn't be a bad idea. Then they put a $6 toll up between here and the interstate, mm-hmm. and I think people's minds and ideas might change pretty quickly.
Well, one of the things I mentioned in my biography is born in North Carolina, grew up in Georgia, and I distinctly remember the first time I drove through the northeastern part of our country, and my immediate thought was, why don't these people pay for their roads? And, you know, as soon as you see that privatization, you process it a little bit differently. It feels a little different.
American presidents serve as commander-in-chief and head of state, but only Congress is supposed to declare war. With Donald Trump's erratic behavior and plans for greatly increased military spending, including new nuclear weapons, many people fear that he will start a war, even a nuclear war. If elected, what will you do to prevent war, particularly with your knowledge, firsthand knowledge of what war means?
Well, thank you for the question, Bob. I think, you know, for me, I think this is one of the reasons that we need people who are veterans, people with military service in the Congress. In 2003, when the Congress authorized the war in Iraq, of the 535 members of Congress, my understanding is that there was only one who had a child serving in the military. And the percentage of veterans in the Congress has never been lower. So we've got to send people that know about this experience to the Congress to be a check on this president. I will say that General Mattis is a Marine general I served under overseas. I have a lot of faith in him as a person, as a leader. I believe he will do everything he can to make sure that reasonable national security decisions are made. When I get to the Congress, one of the committees I'd like to serve on is the Intelligence Committee. I believe my background as a Marine and then also working in technology really lends itself to being a force for good on that committee, whether that means just checking in on the technology we're using and also making sure American citizens know a little bit more about what the government is doing. So I want to be a leader on this issue in the Congress and be a check to some of the erratic behavior by being steady and thoughtful in my approach to how we're collecting intelligence, how we're keeping Americans safe. And obviously, Tim Kaine has been an amazing leader on trying to get the authorization of military force done through the Congress. We have not done that in a very long time. Afghanistan war is more than 16 years old now, and we need more of that. The Congress needs to take responsibility. We cannot keep abdicating. I'm not there yet. Sorry, I shouldn't use we. The Congress should not abdicate responsibility in its role here. They are the only body that's charged with declaring war. That's not the president's job. Unfortunately, they've been dragging their feet, and that's just not the right approach. Yes, it is a lot harder to check the yes box, but that's going to make you be a lot more thoughtful as well.
I think Congress has abdicated more than just that. I think they abdicate mm-hmm. pretty much everything they can do. The focus on getting reelected. All right, I need to interrupt. I apologize. Thanks, RD. Mm-hmm. But we need to take another short break. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Our election special interview with RD Huffsteller. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back. I'm Jeff Leonard, and I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with congressional candidate RD Huffsteller. Bob and RD, we have one more segment, so let's talk about some more issues.
RD, because next year in Congress, some of the issues that you would face if you were elected would be entirely unpredictable. It'd be something that you would not have talked about during the campaign. So we have some general questions. To start, as a very general question, what do you see as the proper role of government?
Government, when folks are working hard and following the rules, government can be part of the system where we get each other's backs. And this has been the example in my life. In Georgia, I used the Hope Scholarship to go to a state school. Basically tuition free. That was a huge hand up. But I had to do my part too, because I had to maintain a B average. And then I think the GI Bill is another good model here, Bob. You do your service, and you get a massive investment in your higher education, which is big, really important to me as well. So, you know, one of the things that we're grappling with now as a society is, how many decisions do we need from D.C. versus the local municipalities in the states? And one of the things I strongly believe in, even more so as I go around the district, Bob, is the 5th District of Virginia has everything that it needs to solve its own problems. Whether it's, you know, the subject matter expertise here in Charlottesville in terms of green energy, or the great work that the folks in Southside are doing to repair their economy from this structural change that's happening, it just over and over and over again validates, if we can have a convener-in-chief at the federal level who can help folks have these conversations in different communities and counties, that's what I view the government is helping to do. Convene people, bring them together, talk about tough issues, Make sure people are getting the resources they need to solve their own problems. And again, any sort of vehicle where people are working hard and we can invest in them, we need to double down on it.
Now, part of that governmental process, and every year Congress should do this part, and that's prepare a budget. This is often a messy process.
Mm-hmm.
What would be your budget priorities if you were elected?
That's a great question, Bob. One of the things that's being proposed right now is moving the budget from an annual process to a two-year process. I think I probably support that simply because I don't think they've gotten a budget in regular working order in a long time now. So I think taking 2 years at a time might be a practical approach to make sure we actually have a budget. Listen, we got to continue to invest in things like education and healthcare, basic research and development. These are things that really propel our economy. And one of the things they've studied, Bob, is entrepreneurship rates at age 64 and 65. And at age 65, someone is much more likely to start a business. That's because they have health. And so it's, again, what I often say about the economy is that the Republicans view the world as if Dwight Eisenhower was the president. They think that as long as we continue to cut that TOPS tax bracket, everything else, little fairy dust comes down and everything is fine. That is just not how the world works right now. We have to invest in education to close that middle skills gap, which we talked about earlier. We've got to make sure that every family can have quality, affordable health care. And yes, that has a big impact on the economy. So that's a good reason to do it, not just because we care about each other, but because it helps the economy. So the budget needs to reflect that. The budget is a priorities document for how we're going to get the country going again. And those are the priorities we need to be investing in.
When you have a budget, the next thing you have to think about is how you're going to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
There are changes to the tax laws. It was the only real congressional accomplishment for Donald Trump. What do you think about that tax law, those changes, and how would you change it again?
So in 1986, the federal government completed a comprehensive tax reform. Any idea how much that was projected to add to the deficit? $0. We just completed a comprehensive tax reform, which is going to add $1.5 trillion to the deficit. That is not a policy that's going to get our economy in the right direction long term. That is a check that our grandchildren are going to have to write. And listen, I'm not one of these people who can't be persuaded that at some points maybe we need some deficit spending, but this is out of control. And it's also not clear what we get from this, Bob. What we know for sure is that there's a historic amount of consolidation in our economy. Big companies are keeping more and more money on their balance sheets, not inventing new technologies, not buying new companies, not having new employees to employ. And so it's sort of a head scratcher why the Republicans would think that the massive percentage of the benefit to this tax bill should go to those corporations. Now, again, I think everybody on the radio here knows the kind of person I want to be in public service, to try to be a problem solver and bring people together and focus like a laser on the economy here in the 5th District. But that's different from saying we're going to write a $1.5 trillion check that we're just not sure what the benefits of it are. And so the changes I would want to make is have a real pro-growth tax bill that invests in closing the middle skills gap. It improves our institutions of higher learning so people are getting skills, not just degrees. And that's what I'm going to continue to be focused on, Bob.
You know, one of the frustrating things for me is in the wake of 2008, they put in a bunch of rules on banking regulations. I think it was Dodd-Frank. And now the Senate and with Democratic support, some Democratic support at least, are rolling back the regulations that sort of helped protect consumers and customers from big banks crashing our economy again. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, a big reason, and I know there's a little bit of a divide here from different parts in the party, but my understanding, and I'll be completely candid, and I have not read that bill, but my understanding of the bill is the reason it got support is there's been a lot of closures of our small banks. And in Virginia in particular, a vast majority of our small community banks have closed. And I think it has something to do with the capitalization level they had in the original bill, and they wanted to adjust that. In my mind, that's a very common sense thing to do, that if the banks are closing because we put a specific level in the bill too high or too low, we probably should adjust that.
Are you listening to 94.7 WPVC's 5th District Candidate Forum? I'm Jeff Leonard, here in studio today with my partner, Bob McAdams. Studio also is R.D. Hufstetler. Republicans have been using every trick possible to keep Democrats from getting elected. Gerrymandering, restrictive voter ID laws, purging voter registration rolls just before election, reducing days and locations for voting. The list goes on. What action should Congress take to protect each person's right to vote?
Well, the first thing we need to do is reauthorize the Voting Rights Amendment. There's no reason that Congress can't do its job. It was warned by the Supreme Court years ago that they needed to adjust the formula. They didn't, and so the Supreme Court struck it down. We need to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. There still needs to be preclearance in some of these maps because people have a terrible track record. And that's exactly what you're seeing right now, is people continuing to swing the pendulum for political purposes. There's voter fraud is a non-existent entity in our country. That just doesn't happen. There are very small instances of this that have been, prosecuted or whatever. And we obviously need to support a robust system that's inclusive so that people can vote. The other thing that we need to start thinking about as a country is, can we make Election Day a holiday? As Democrats, we should always be making it easier to vote. We should make it more inclusive. We ought to invite everybody to participate in every election. And I don't support any of these restrictions. I am very hopeful that the Supreme Court will rule that gerrymandering is unconstitutional. It clearly, if it is not unconstitutional, has a massive bias on our politics right now. It is strangleholding who we send to D.C. to represent us, and I'm hopeful that a solution will be coming forward.
You know, I've tried to reach out to our congressman and get him to come on 94.7. So I feel the frustration that other voters feel when they write letters to their congressman while lobbyists write health insurance repeal and tax bills. How would you change a legislative process to restore integrity so that people can actually have access to their legislator?
Well, we want to be a responsive campaign. We want to be ideally a responsive congressman. Power derives from the people in this country. It's not that complicated in a lot of ways. And, you know, we often joke on my team, what does Tom Garrett do? He does not meet with his constituents. He does not pass bills. He just doesn't do anything. And to me, that's extremely irritating. And again, we often say, listen, even if you take the letter off this guy's name, he's just simply not doing a good job. He's not doing a good job because he's not representing us, because he's not writing bills that make our lives better. And that's why we're out to get him, is to, I think, try to restore a little transparency, a little access, and a little integrity to this process.
When they talk about regular order, how do you understand that, and how would that influence the process of legislation?
I'm not as familiar with that term, Bob, but let me just say what I think I understand about it. Right now, in the House of Representatives, there's a concept called the Hastert Rule. And the Hastert Rule says that unless a bill has the support of the majority, it will not be voted upon. That's a completely flawed premise. A bill could have the support of the majority of the House of Representatives and the majority of the American people and still not get a vote in the House of Representatives. So I think we need to strongly consider whether that's necessary at all and if there's any measures to take it so we don't have that rule. It's just an informal rule that the Republicans have right now. And regular working order, from my understanding, means everybody can participate in crafting the bill. And I know, as Americans, sometimes we struggle with, did this get added or did that get added? But it's a democratic process. People have to be included. We have to make sure that the bill that gets through can get through the House of Representatives.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 5th District Congressional Candidate Forum. Our interview today is with R.D. Hufstetler. I'm Bob McAdams. Artie, let's talk about getting elected.
Yes.
The 5th District goes from close to the Maryland border up there in Fauquier County all the way to the border with North Carolina in the South. If nominated, what is your strategy for winning the election in November?
Well, we want to build the most robust ground game in the history of the 5th District. Right now, we have 9 field organizers. My campaign has made more than 100,000 phone calls. I have personally made more than 18,000 phone calls. We are very, very proud of the ground game we're assembling. We think it will be essential in November to have a grassroots movement. We're very proud that we have a donation from all 23 of our cities and counties. So it is a bottom-up movement to make sure that we can beat Tom Garrett this fall. And I was on the call last night, Bob, with my field team. And one of the things I told them is, you know, I'm a recovering chemist, as I mentioned earlier, and the atomic unit of a campaign is a conversation. And nothing is going to change that. We are going to have more conversations with our neighbors, with people that we worship with, people we go to school with, people we work with, than any campaign. And that's the strategy, is when a rumor pops up in one of our rural communities or in our small cities, the RDH campaign is going to be there to make sure that the facts get out through neighbor-to-neighbor contact.
Well, the 5th District covers an area that's bigger than the state of New Jersey, and it includes many media markets, many expensive media markets, both a ground game and getting the word out to people who you don't contact directly, costs money. How will you fund your campaign? Will you accept or reject contributions from Dominion Energy, from other corporations, from corporate PACs?
We are not going to take any money from Dominion Energy, and we have not taken any money from any corporate PAC. We do have a median donation in this campaign of $25. We have thousands of individual contributions. We have a donation from all 50 states, and as I said, all 23 cities and counties. We have been very fortunate in this campaign to outraise the other Democratic candidates in the country, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and in the 5th District of Virginia. That's something we're very proud of, is to have the grassroots support of our neighbors and friends. And, you know, that is a necessity of modern politics, is you do have to use paid media to communicate with voters. You just simply cannot meet enough folks, unfortunately. And we're trying to do both. We're trying to meet as many of our fellow friends and citizens here in the 5th District, as well as do a good job of making sure we have the resources to win our campaign. And, Bob, I just want to say one quick thing. We are extremely proud that great organizations like Vote Vets and With Honor that work to get veterans into politics are both supporting my campaign. In Pennsylvania 18th election, the Vote Vets, that I saw this on, saw them tweet this out, they were the organization that spent the most to get Connor Lamb elected, the single organization. That was in their tweet. I think they spent a couple $100,000. And, you know, unfortunately, the Koch brothers are just going to try to write a check for this seat. And so the way we check that is a grassroots movement where people are energized and excited about what we're doing, but also having great organizations like Vote Vets and With Honor engaged in our campaign.
Yeah, against Connor Lamb, I've heard different figures, but it was like $10, $11 million that the Republicans spent to try to protect that seat, and they came up short.
That's right. And I think, to be completely candid, Bob, and of course I care about and love my other colleagues here on the Democratic side, but I think the Connor Lamb formula is our formula here. A fellow Marine who served, who has a background that fits the district, that's our formula. We just want to use that playbook, make sure we have the resources to win, and talk about the things that we really value in this campaign, which is listening to our neighbors, trying to figure out what the right thing to do for the district and the country is, and doing that every single day.
Now, to get to that campaign, you have one big step, and that is to get the nomination. The 5th Congressional District Democratic Committee decided to have a caucus plus convention process in order to do the nomination. How will you work with that process? You might take a little time here to explain what it means to have a caucus convention process to get the nomination.
Well, I would just say don't get too worked up about it. You know, we'll get through this together. We've put up a caucus guide on our website, which will explain this thoroughly. But the basic premise is all of the caucuses are proportional. If you think we're the best candidate to beat Tom Garrett this fall, you look up your local location, you go, and they say, this is RD's corner, and you go stand in that corner. They count everybody, and they distribute the delegates. So our goal is to run the most robust field team here possible, and to get the most people in the most rooms. Think of it as an electoral college with 23 states. And that's exactly what we're going to do. And that's what will happen over the course of the 14th through the 21st of April.
So I can't just go to my local polling place and vote for you. I have to register as a delegate. And then once I register as a delegate, then I have to go to Farmville, correct?
So, Jeff, this is actually the one thing I definitely want to dispel in this discussion.
Okay.
You do not need to register as a delegate. If you can hear my voice, all you have to do is go to your local caucus. My team is well on its way to getting all the delegates taken care of. You don't worry about that. Don't lose any sleep over that. All you need to do is look at the caucus guide on our website, find where your local caucus is, and show up. And if you show up, we want the most inclusive, robust process we possibly can. And don't worry about any of the delegate stuff. We got that taken care of. That's my team's job. All you need to do is go to your local caucus. And that will occur sometime between April 14th and the 21st. And those delegates, Jeff, they'll be apportioned proportional to the people in the room. Does that make sense and seem reasonable?
It does. It's confusing to people who aren't necessarily savvy in any sort of electoral process. But it's not an open primary. You know, it's something that you have to specifically dedicate yourself and commit to prior to that time.
Yes. Look. We spoke out that we thought a primary was the best way to select our nominee, but the committee has decided this, and we're going to do our very best to support them in building the best process that we can. My campaign has identified a lot of folks that want to support our campaign and caucus for us, and we're going to make sure they show up. And all you have to do is the same. We'll take care of all the paperwork and stuff like that. All you need to do is find out where your local caucus is.
And what day will the decision be made to who will represent the 5th District as the Democratic nominee?
And that is a little more complicated because the caucuses feed into a convention on May 5th. But most Democratic voters here in the 5th District don't really need to worry about that. Just go to your caucus. But the nominee will be chosen at a convention in Farmville on May 5th.
So on the evening of May 5th, I will know who the Democratic nominee is for the 5th
that
District.
That is correct, Jeff. Absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. RD, what's that website again?
RDFORVA.com. RDforVA.com. And you'll find on there a little bit about our background. You'll find our values of duty, empathy, and commitment. You'll find some pieces that we've written about policy. And, of course, we'd be honored to earn your support in this process.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Artie. Thanks so much for spending this hour with the WPVC listeners. Next in our series of election interviews, our final one is with Leslie Coburn. She'll join us here in studio. So tune in next Saturday for another election interview special. And thanks for listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
Listening to the 94.7 WPVC Election Special Candidates Forum. The program is underwritten by the Daily Progress with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Join us again next Saturday at 11 as we talk to yet another candidate for the Democratic nomination for 5th District U.S. Congressperson. You can also suggest questions for the candidates at 947WPVC.org or through the WPVC Facebook page.